Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Carium, the telehealth platform enabling healthcare's digital transformation, helping you care for people within the fabric of their daily lives. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Acacia Parks, Chief Science Officer at Happify Health. Acacia, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So Acacia, what I always like to do at the beginning of a show is give my guest a chance to provide a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
Sure. My background is in psychology. I got my PhD at the University of Pennsylvania and actually became a professor at first, but it was as a professor that I met the eventual co-founders of Happify Health, who kind of approached me about this amorphous idea of a product we might be able to make where we take research-based things and turn it into something accessible to the general public. And their background was in casual games. So they were all about kind of high utilization, high exposure, but didn't know exactly what to put into such a product. And so they approached me about that. And I actually learned last month, I was the first person they talked to about this idea. So I guess the first member of Happify Health. I consulted for them for some time. But my current role, I think back then I was sort of a makeshift product designer, right? I was kind of like figuring out, like, how do we take, what research works for people? Which is really like kind of the bread and butter of what I do today as well. It's like, I want to understand what research is out there that isn't reaching the general public. And I want to do everything I can to make sure that it reaches the general public. And having come from an academic background and seen so much research of things that work hanging out in the file drawer, real world access and dissemination is kind of the mission of my career. These days at Happify, a lot of what I do is scientific strategy. So it's kind of thinking about, for all of the different things the company is trying to achieve, what are the things they want to be able to say about their products, and what's the research that's needed to demonstrate those things? And, you know, there's sort of the presumption that we've built a product that's good. And the question is, how do we show that it's good in ways that will speak the same language as health plans, speak the same language as potential pharma partners, speak the same language as consumers, right? So we've addressed all of these different markets over the year. And my role is to kind of make sure that we're doing the right kind of research so that when we go to explain the value of our product, that message is clear.
Yeah, and actually, that's a very interesting perspective on it, because with your role as chief science officer, I'm not sure that's necessarily like a role that I've heard identified too often.
Yeah, CMOs, you know, do this a lot of the time.
Yeah, so I was going to ask, you know, it seems like it kind of overlaps with a chief medical officer or, you know, some type of clinical officer. So, you know, kind of where are the overlaps, but also where are the distinctions?
Yeah. So, I mean, the important piece of information here is that we started as a direct-to-consumer, non-clinical business. So as a product that was to reduce stress, improve resilience, all these kinds of kind of more distant, less clinical claims, you know, we spent years living that life. And so it made sense to have a chief science officer, but not really a chief medical officer at that point. We really only appointed a full-time chief medical officer, Murray Zucker, a few months ago. He'd been consulting for us, but he became full-time a few months ago because the company had sort of arrived in such a clinical space that was needed. So understanding that the clinical part came later, really only about 3 years ago, that we really began working on prescription digital therapeutics, things where we're making claims about managing any kind of disease. All of that is relatively recent, whereas my role is relatively ancient in the lifespan of the company. So we kind of had to, like, we still had the scientific need, and it didn't make sense to, you know, axe that and start over. But instead, we added a CMO to the mix, and we worked together.
And I think that makes sense, because, you know, just knowing some of the distinctions from, you know, I guess from my perspective on the legal side of things, that you want to be careful of not blurring a line or staying on, or to stay on a particular side of a line, depending on where you're trying to get your product to fit into, you know, I'll call it the broader digital health world.
Well, and it's important because I did clinical psychology graduate school, but I did not get licensed. Treating patients is not something that I've done in a full-time capacity ever. So, the more clinical we got, the more it made sense. Like, we need a psychiatrist involved. His perspective is relevant too. And like, I know enough to be dangerous, but you sort of grow in the right direction depending on where your company is headed. And in this case, we needed to kind of double down on the clinical aspect. And you'll see all over our org, we're starting to bring in licensed clinicians because that's not me.
No, and I think that is definitely very interesting. And I think bringing in the licensed clinicians certainly pushes you in a different direction. But I actually want to kind of go back to one of the initial statements or kind of concepts that you brought up, that you said, obviously you said you have the psychology background, but the co-founders came from a gaming background.
Yes.
So I would be very interested to hear, where the alignment is, but then, and hopefully this statement is correct, but with gaming, you're trying to hook people in and, arguably get them to some degree addicted to using your product, your solution. So, yes. How do you adapt those concepts into a healthcare context?
It's a work in progress, but I would say yes. The origin story of our company is very much one. For a while, we had the slogan "Science meets delight," right? So it's we're trying to take what we know will help people, and that has historically failed to reach them for one reason or another, either because maybe it's too much effort or too complicated for them, or because it never reaches them in the first place. So, the science has some issues. There's this huge gap of 10 years or something from when something is found effective to when it makes it into practice, if it ever does. So taking that problem and trying to solve it using consumer engagement expertise plus gaming expertise, that has always been kind of what we're trying to do in different ways over the years. So it's tricky, but, ultimately, there's always the capacity anytime you're trying to help somebody do something healthy, for example, eating healthy. So this is something I've been thinking about a lot. I use a cool app that helps me track all the things that I eat. And there's a subset of people for whom that becomes obsessive and triggers whatever eating disorder that they might have. And that's not for everybody. There's some small subset of people that overdoes it and it's not healthy. And that's always a concern with anything where you talk about we know what makes games addictive and people genuinely get addicted to games. So let's apply that to a healthy behavior. In practice, we don't see that much in mental health though. In part because I think, tracking food means obsessing about food, which is part of an eating disorder. But we haven't really seen that corollary with mental health. It is always a challenge to get people to engage, but you don't see people dying because they're sitting in a chair playing a digital health app and they forget to eat, right? You hear about this World of Warcraft and these other types of games where people get seriously ill just because they're so addicted to it. I haven't seen it yet. It's not a major dialogue in the space. It's more about how do we really get people engaged? How do we make this a part of people's lives forever? Right. Because that's ultimately what we're trying to do, is not get somebody to use an app for a few weeks, but learn some stuff they're going to keep doing their entire life. And that is massive behavior change. It's very difficult to achieve.
Obviously, I think kind of, as you said, start pushing into the discussion around mental health as the target for the digital health solution. How have you seen either the engagement or the product delivery change, just over the years, but also thinking about probably the past coming up on 2 years now of COVID, given that there have been so many reports of the use of digital health or telemental health, kind of skyrocketing and being seen as a way of providing, to some degree, kind of addressing access issues that have been longstanding and widespread?
Yeah, that's a multi-pronged question. Let me see if I can keep it in my head. First of all, I think, one of the things that we have discovered over the past few years, because we did start off as a primarily mental health company, is that mental health is an underlying component of nearly every physical health problem you can imagine. So, if you have diabetes, having poor mental health makes things worse for your diabetes. It's not just that, you know, it's worse for, you know, that you have worse mental health, but that if you have poor mental health, it's difficult to implement complex treatment plans. It's difficult to have the motivation to implement complex treatment plans, to get in to see your doctor. And as a result, you see greater chances of things like, you know, ending up in the ER because the diabetes is poorly treated. And there's corollaries like that for many different health conditions. And COVID just punctuated that, right? Because between COVID and other chronic conditions, now a very large proportion of the world population is dealing with some sort of health something. And self-care is tied to mental health. So there's a place, I think, for mental health to be not just mental health, but really just health. You know, they're inextricably intertwined. So that's kind of to answer your first question. I think, you know, COVID has punctuated something we were already seeing, which is that you can look at, you know, diseases like MS, which, you know, we had a publicly announced relationship with Sanofi to look at multiple sclerosis. There are places where you can see that when you improve the mental health of a person with multiple sclerosis, aspects of their multiple sclerosis improve. You're not treating the multiple sclerosis, but you're sort of removing impediments to self-care and potential, you know, healing. So, you know, I think those things are really important. And again, you know, people are dealing with not only like COVID itself, but grief and anxiety. You know, I had probably a 6-month bout of generalized anxiety I'd never had before during the pandemic, like no history of anxiety. And it just came out of nowhere. And it's like, you hear these stories everywhere of people just suddenly, you know, whatever was like hanging out in their genetic scene, but had never been triggered, just like came out. So, you know, there are these mental health needs, but also I think, you know, physical health needs exacerbate that. So that's, should I stop or should I keep answering the question?
Yeah, no, actually, I mean, kind of what you just talked about, I do want to dig into that a little bit.
Let's do it.
Because, you know, as you were talking about it or it suggested, it's maybe we shouldn't have these kind of defined labels, but we should view it all as health, you know, health and keeping people healthy. So do you see a pathway to help get to that stage? Because arguably that's, you know, take your pick of any type of care interaction. And unless you're talking about traditional medicine, there is a perspective that let's just view it all as health and put it all together categorically like that. And as you were suggesting, then you can start seeing all the interactions and understanding that you can't silo different areas of care.
Allow me to climb onto my soapbox. So this is a thing I'm extremely passionate about. When I got into the work that I do now, and this was, I'm not going to date myself, but it was when I was an undergraduate, I read about the concept that depression and anxiety, generalized anxiety, could be prevented. So this blew my mind. Like I'd read all this stuff about, oh yeah, cognitive therapy works for treatment. And I was all, you know, excited about that. And I was ready to just go into the world of studying how to treat depression and anxiety, because those are the things that I cared about the most. And then I learned that if you identify people who are at risk, they're showing some symptoms, but nobody would diagnose them yet. And you do all the same stuff you would do to treat them. You give them the same, basically the same cognitive therapy program, but in advance, that you reduce the chances that 2 years later, they go on to actually develop those diseases that they're at risk for. Whoa, this was huge for me. Like when I saw this, I was like, I got to go work with the guy who did this research. Marty Seligman ended up being my advisor. Like I went to go work on these projects. So I'm extremely passionate about the idea that mental health is a continuum, and that it's inextricably tied to physical health, and that the way of the future is to understand these things about a given person and put them in the right place at the right time for where they are at that moment, which could be a combination of mental and physical health care. It could be telemedicine. It could be in-person treatment, depending on the problem. It could be, you know, a remote mental health thing, but an in-person physical health thing, or vice versa, right? So this is all about, it's about AI. It's about, you know, using smartphone data and sensor data to really understand what's going on with people without asking them to give you a ton of data, which they will never do just because it's effort, right? Like, how can we learn passively about what people are doing and where they are, integrate with their health records, all of these things to their benefit so that they can come in and do some kind of, you know, assessment and then be placed in the right place. And key to this is that this is not just for people with major depressive disorder or multiple sclerosis. It's for people who might be at risk for anything, right? Those people belong in this system too, as do people who aren't even at risk, but like maybe just, you know, want some stress management skills or like want some education about how to eat healthily, right? All of these things exist independently, but not in a single place with some sort of smart way to assess who needs what. And this has been something I think healthcare has been shuffling towards for a long time, but now it has just become so urgent because A, in-person treatment is so rare because COVID makes it so that, you know, we have to have lower volumes of patients. And there weren't enough doctors anyway. Like that was something that we talked about over email, right? It's like, there aren't enough doctors, even if they were perfectly accessible to people. So there has to be a way of sending people to lower touch things if that's right for them, so that the higher touch things are reserved for the people who actually need them. It's an old concept, but it's only actually starting to happen. I mean, even like with some of these mergers and acquisitions you've probably heard about, that we're starting to see different parts of this overall milieu kind of starting to band together as a single company so that they can be more of a one-stop shop. It's, you know, last 6 months. So it's finally starting, I think, to happen. But yeah, I think it's so important that we stop doing this. Like I have 18 different sources of care and I have to keep track of them all as the patient. That's why people don't get care.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And thank you for hopping onto your soapbox for that point. you know, and for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Acacia Parks from Happify Health. And we've been talking about, you know, kind of the science of around driving better engagement, as well as now talking about integration of care across all different modalities. And kind of continuing on that integrated care piece, you know, I think you were starting to touch on it a little bit, but, you know, kind of what do you see as were the barriers to driving that full integration? And I know this is going to be another very broad two-part question, but you were also starting to get into the direction of, as you said, the shuffling forward of getting better. You know, what do you see as being, you know, kind of factors that can help further drive and encourage that both the integration of mental and physical health, but also the integration of all different modalities of delivering care?
So by the time I'm done answering the one you just asked, I'm going to have forgotten the first one. So just bring it back to me. So, I mean, I think in terms of moving towards a sort of precision care model, and like you hear that word, that phrase, it again has become much more popular in the last few months. It's one that I've been thinking about, again, since an undergraduate. I wrote an essay about how in schools, like they can do a tiered care model where they assess what everybody needs and send them to the right place. I'm like, this is old. It's an old concept. But to move towards it, it seems like, you know, some companies are thinking mergers and acquisitions are the way to go. I mean, that's certainly one way to go, right? If enough companies eat up other companies that are doing some of these different things, you know, we hear about like telemedicine companies combining with mental health companies that are, provide digital solutions. We hear about, there was a recent deal about about CrossFit kind of moving into telehealth. I mean, there's some clear, crazy kind of merger acquisition activity. Clearly that's one way to go. You know, I think it's also possible we'll see newer startups come in, and I've seen some of this at the last, DTX East, where there are some companies coming in and like, this is just their goal from the outset. Their goal is this. And so they're, you know, they have it as opposed to companies pivoting into it and then potentially combining with other companies that also were sort of independent. Oh, you were asking about barriers, right? So, I can kind of combine that because it's like, if we've got a bunch of point solutions and it requires 12 of them to achieve what we just described, like how does anybody make money out of that when you're, you know, individual companies that have individual business models? I do think there are a few paths forward and different places are trying different paths forward, right? Some companies can pivot to this internally. Other companies are combining. Other companies are starting with this as a goal to begin with. I don't know which one's going to be the way, but it's nice to see that people are trying to get there.
And I guess other outside of the companies, as you said, you know, I think I fully agree with you. The point solution kind of aim for a startup is arguably and hopefully kind of going by a little bit by the wayside. Because I, you know, as you were saying, having something that's more comprehensive, and you know, I think platform has also become the buzzword now. Of you know, you want to be able to do have the capability of either plugging in stuff so you can do everything, or just being able to do everything yourself.
Yeah,
but. You know, kind of what do you, or from your perspective, what were some of the systemic barriers that just the healthcare system writ large had or probably still has in place that discouraged that comprehensive approach to?
Well, health plans have to want to change. Or the care has to happen dun, 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 outside of a health plan. Right. So you see some of these models. I mean, I'll just use this personal example because I have migraines. And so, I used Cove, right? I don't know if you've heard about Cove, but it's, you know, it's one of these, you see them all around, kind of one stop. You've got migraines, you speak to a doctor there who's a migraine specialist, they prescribe you some stuff. There's no health plan involvement. Like they somehow offer it to you at a relatively cheap rate and they mail it to you the end, like they dispense it as well. So, I mean, I think there are starting to be providers. I've seen them for weight loss as well, where like, you know, you buy a package and it has nothing to do with your health plan. It's all out of pocket. And their business model is making it so that people will pay for it out of pocket. That's also happening. So I don't know if that's the future, but it's certainly a way that I see companies exploring because presumably it's hard to enact change in both the FDA and health plans. That said, I mean, I think there's also really concerted work. Our company works with the Digital Therapeutics Alliance, and there's a lot of kind of advocacy work with health plans to just really understand what they're looking for in terms of evidence so that we're ready. But I think everybody's realized that like FDA clearance, you don't like walk up to a health plan and they're like, okay, come on in. You've got FDA clearance. Like it's not enough. There's a lot more that has to be done. And that's just to get one digital therapeutic in the door. Now, you know, once you get into systemic change, that's a whole other deal. So, I mean, it's a long road to be sure, because startups may respond quickly, but huge organizations are slow to adapt, not because of anything negative about them, just because they're large and what they're doing is working for them. So you really have to show them why they'd be motivated to change. But to that point, I think we have to change how we think about evidence as well, because, you know, from a scientific strategy standpoint, I've been thinking about this a lot. Like, how do we validate an entire group of things that a person is sorted between? And it's not really about the individual efficacy of each, though obviously that's necessary. It's kind of about improving the outcomes of a person who comes through our system versus just is using the health plan normally, right? It's like, is the fact that we sorted them ultimately gonna keep them out of the emergency room, make it so they show up to more preventative care, make it so they have fewer problem visits? Those types of objective outcomes, I think, are the key. But we have to change how we think about research, because we're so used to like, okay, here's my one thing, and I'm gonna do a clinical trial on this one thing. There's no one thing, right? There's dozens of things, and each person is only going to get one of those dozen things, or maybe two of those dozen things. So they're getting a fundamentally different treatment. And the point is not which treatment, the point is the system.
Right. And I think as you're just kind of suggesting, it's like, there are so many different variables that you're not going to be able to control for each of them. It's, you're going to, the method is going to have to be developed to kind of take all the data, analyze it and figure it, and then try and refine it. It sounds like refine processes, because it's most likely some combination of things as opposed to just one factor that's driving a positive, a more positive outcome for someone going through and having that ability to access all of those kind of new features or new services.
Yeah, the variables you're interested in sort of change in the way you have to analyze it changes as well, because it's more about like, did they go through the system at all or not? And there's sort of this assumption that you've just validated each component of the system. So that's not really what you're testing in this study. And then to kind of think about, well, you know, were they matched properly or not? Like, that's kind of the key question, is not like which thing were they matched to, but was it the right thing for them in retrospect after they used it for a month or something like that? You know, you kind of have to go back and be like, is my system properly classifying people? And when it does, how is that objectively improving their health? But like, that's a whole, I mean, first of all, that type of research takes, you know, a year or two to do. I mean, right? Because you have to see how people's health plays out. It's not like a short term, I can reduce your depressive symptoms if you just hang out and, you know, and use my app for 8 weeks or 12 weeks. These are long-term changes. If you're trying to look at percentage of people who end up in the ER, like, that doesn't happen every week, right? That's a thing that happens with long-term poorly managed diabetes or whatever other health condition you're looking at. So these are sort of long-term questions. And that's the hardest thing, is that it's a short-term urgent problem and the answers are long-term. So that's a conundrum. I'm not sure how that will, you know, go forward other than for certain investors or certain health plans to agree that this is urgent enough that it's worth it to do it together instead of waiting until it's validated before investing anything into it. Because it can't get validated unless somebody invests in it, right?
Yeah, there's so many different chicken and the egg problems there. Because as you said, you can't validate if you don't have the investment, but also you probably don't have the timeline to wait for all the evidence to come out before you start pushing it more broadly too. Since, you know, as you suggested, you know, that might be a year or two before you have enough, you know, information to start actually.
That's from when you start
assessment,
right? So like, what about all the planning time and you've got to develop it? So like, it's years.
Yes. Yeah. So believe it or not, we are already almost out of time. So
you
know, while that gives a lot to think about, I would just like to give, you know, Keisha, give you one last idea to iterate on, which is, you know, what has you most excited for the upcoming year?
Honestly, you know, I think we have some pretty exciting things up our sleeve, but I'm also equally excited about some of the companies I see emerging. You know, we all kind of went into our hidey holes during the pandemic, and then, you know, conferences started meeting in person again only recently. And so I went to DTX East, and there were companies there I had never heard of that had popped up just since the last DTX meeting, which was, you know, 2 years ago, who have done so much cool stuff and nothing like what we're doing. And like, that's important because this field needs you know, it needs diversity in people. You know, there are companies looking at, you know, gut biome and like trying to help people understand, you know, ways to improve their gut flora. Like, that is in no way in competition with what we're doing, but it's super cool. And I'm glad it's there. And like, ultimately, I feel like, you know, all of these things could be working together really well. So it's the new stuff, I think, coupled with, I think we're all understanding that we have to adapt to this, the global health situation that we're in, and the existing companies are doing that. And I'm excited to see that play out, but I'm equally excited to see these new companies that are emerging with just cool, totally out of the box ideas that were born in the pandemic, right? It's like what I was saying before. It's like there are companies pivoting that pre-existed, and there are companies that only exist because they saw a gap during the pandemic and they were created with that in mind. I think both of those are super cool. So I think that in a year or two, there are going to be aspects of digital health that we never anticipated that make the field much more rich. And for me, that's like opening a present at Christmas. Just kind of, whoa, there are people doing this. How cool. New ways to monitor people's physical health, for example. These sort of like wearables are getting cooler and cooler. So for me, it's like the technology that lets us understand more about people, because ultimately that's going to feed into this precision care concept even more. Like, knowing there was this deal with 23andMe for, you know, kind of precision medicine that happened recently. Like, okay, so genetics, gut biome, better wearables, these are all things that contribute to that data, that algorithm that needs to happen to understand where a person should be placed. And like, no individual one's going to be the answer. But if I'm thinking ahead to things combining or being combined in some way, that's very exciting.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think as you said, as everyone keeps coming out of the hibernation from the pandemic and you get to see all these new ideas coming out, it's going to be great. But as I said, believe it or not, we are already out of time. So I want to thank my guest, Keisha Parks, for a great conversation today.
Thank you.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.